Welcome to EAN Cast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to our weekly EAN podcast. My name is Barbara Tettenborn. I'm the editor-in-chief of e-learning of the European Academy of Neurology. And for the summer weeks, we thought we'd produce specials about neurological diseases and traveling. And today we start with epilepsy and traveling. So on my side today for this topic are Simona Balestrini and Marian Galovic, both associate editors of our editorial board. Simona is associate professor of child neurology and psychiatry at the neuroscience department, Children's Hospital and University of Florence in Italy. And she's also consultant neurologist at the Chalfont Center for Epilepsy and senior clinical research fellow at UCL Queen Square Institute of Neurology in London. And also with us today is Marian Galovic. He is working at the Department of Neurology at the University Hospital in Zurich in Switzerland and currently head of the epilepsy unit there. Besides that, he is chair of the International League Against Epilepsy Career Development Commission and past chair of the International League Against Epilepsy Young Epilepsy Section. So hello, Simona and Marian. Good morning.
Hello.
Thank you for taking time today for our podcast. We always try to include epilepsy patients in our regular daily life as much as possible. And our goal in treating and caring for people with epilepsy is always to enable them to have a fulfilling life. And I personally believe that for most people, traveling is possibly part of that. But there are some issues which have to be raised and which we will discuss today. So I start with my first question to probably both of you. Should people with epilepsy travel at all? Is there a general recommendation you can give to people with epilepsy regarding traveling?
So, yes, that's a very important question. And my answer would be yes, of course, people with epilepsy can travel. But it would be important that we have a discussion with them, so to address all the specific adjustment they may need in order to travel. Every person with epilepsy is different, so they may have different level of severity in terms of their seizure presentation, different level of seizure control and frequency, and also different medication they may need to take. Of course, the first consideration is about the destination of traveling, because of course every destination may have specific requirements. We should consider also the time zone, and we should consider the way they would travel, for example, if they need to take a flight. Also that we need to consider their comorbidity. So really our advice should be tailored on their specific disease profile.
So you think it's like an individually tailored process to plan the travel more than other people have to without epilepsy?
I would think so. And then perhaps, Marian, we could discuss each single aspect if you agree.
Yeah, I think we go through it point by point, and maybe we start with the flying. What about flying? Are there special recommendations you give to people with epilepsy and their caregivers regarding the flights? And are you aware of any airlines which have special requests regarding people with epilepsy? I hope there aren't, but I'm afraid there might be.
That's an excellent question, Barbara. And people with epilepsy may be a bit anxious before boarding a flight. But to be honest, I have not experienced any major problems in my patients who have epilepsy who are embarking on flights. And particularly if the epilepsy is well controlled, I wouldn't expect any major problems. And I think most airlines would not even require medical clearance for people with epilepsy who have well controlled epilepsy to board the airplane. Although there are some guidelines that they may need to follow. So they may need to require medical clearance if they had a convulsive seizure within 24 hours before boarding a flight. But in people who are well controlled, this is usually not required. But every airline is a bit different. So in people with epilepsy who have frequent seizures, I recommend them to actually get in touch with their airline and tell them about the epilepsy because the airline may want to get in touch with them ahead of travel to discuss any safety instructions. And what I also tell them usually is to take the medication on board with them. So this is okay in most countries, and it is also allowed to take liquids in the hand luggage, because in some cases the hold luggage may get lost or may arrive late, and this could sort of provoke seizures if they don't get their medication on time. But they will obviously need to carry their prescriptions or even a medical certificate for their medications with them in order to be able to take the medication in their hand luggage. And then we have a couple of patients who have neurostimulation, like vagal nerve stimulation or deep brain stimulation. And usually it's not recommended for them to use AirPod scanners. It is probably safe, but the device producers recommend them not to use these scanners. So they may want to opt for a pat-down check instead.
Yeah, I think that's a very important advice. First, to inform the airline beforehand to ask for special requirements, and second, to use a different check through. If you have a long flight, there might be time zone changes during the flight, and once you embark from the flight, you might be in a totally different time. So how to handle the medication when changing the time zones? Do you have any rule of thumb? Some I know a few, and they are quite difficult, so you have to calculate a lot, but I think there are probably easier things to handle that problem.
Yes, so I think the main requirement is they maintain as much as possible the same time interval between each administration of medication. So that is what usually I recommend to patients. So of course they need the adjustment. So for example, if they take the medication every, let's say, 6 or 8 hours, they should try to adjust the medication intake according to that hour. So they need to keep the original, let's say, time zone to keep taking the medication around the same time. And then, of course, if they arrive to destination and that adjustment require, let's say, they waking up in the middle of the night, then even if they delay or take the medication a bit earlier by 1 or 2 hours, that usually doesn't have a major impact. So again, I think I really always advise the patient, depending on their specific kind of habit in taking the medication, and as Marian said, depending also on their level of seizure control.
But let's say if there's a time change of 12 hours, so it's a complete change of day and night, and if the people stay for 2 or 3 weeks, do you recommend like a slowly adaption to the new time zone, 1 hour every day, like our biorhythm might do it as with the sleeping, or what do you do then?
I think 12 hours is actually relatively easy, because if they take the medication twice a day, then they just take the morning dose. So what they need to do is, while they're traveling, to take another dose of medication in the middle of their travels. It gets more tricky if there's smaller time zone change. So if it's around 3 to 6 hours, that gets slightly trickier. And it depends whether they're traveling west or east. So when they're traveling west, the days get longer artificially. And when they're traveling east, the days get shorter. So if they stick to their regular routine, they may need to take more or less of their regular medication. So for example, if one of my patients travels west and they stay for a longer time, they may need to take some additional medication depending on what the time zone difference is. If the time zone difference is around 3 to 6 hours, I usually recommend them to take a quarter of their daily dose in addition to their normal dose, when they arrive at the destination. If the time zone difference is more than 6 hours, I usually recommend to take half their daily dose in addition to the usual dose when they arrive at the destination. But it's just more or less a rule of thumb, but it worked reasonably well for my patients.
That sounds good. Thank you. So I think that there will be a lot of help for our listeners for advising people with epilepsy on traveling. We live in a progressively heating world, and the effects of climate change have more and more impact on all of us. Is there a special impact of heat on seizures? And what do people with epilepsy have to keep in mind if traveling into countries with very high temperatures?
Thank you. Yes, that's a very important question. And unfortunately, it does not only apply to people who are traveling, because I think we are all experiencing the impact of climate change in our daily lives. And actually, there is now a lot of also research work to really understand what's the impact of the change in climate around the world and in people with any health condition, but also we are specifically focusing on people with epilepsy. So we do know for certain already that there are some specific epilepsy etiologies that are more susceptible to the change in temperature. And one example is, for example, an epilepsy due to a mutation in a sodium channel gene. The epilepsy is Dravet syndrome, and typically these type of epilepsy start with seizure triggered by fever and by also increased external temperature, so not only internal temperature. And this epilepsy is a severe type of epilepsy syndrome, is an epileptic encephalopathy. And then it evolves with also other seizure types, not only precipitated by high temperature, and also with intellectual disability and other important comorbidities. But it's not only this the example of epilepsy precipitated by high temperature. There are other genetic epilepsies that we know they are severely impacted by not only increased temperature, sometimes even just really sudden changes in temperature. And that's what is happening in our world, because we know that there are really more severe variation in temperature, and there are also more extreme climate events. And of course, this may be of danger to people with epilepsy. So our first really basic recommendation should be to try to keep the temperature as stable as possible. So for example, use air conditioning. So we need to do that if it's too hot. Hydration, especially if people travel to exotic destination where temperature can be very high and wet, and there is wet climate. We don't know yet how increased temperature may affect drug bioavailability. That's another factor that is being investigated, because of course, bioavailability of drugs may change according to different body temperature and this different level of hydration. So that's something that, of course, one should consider at some point. But at the moment, we don't have specific recommendation according to that. And then, of course, one should try to ensure that access to, let's say, emergency service should be maintained in case of extreme climate event. And of course, this may not be predictable, and we experience similar things during the pandemic, but that's another factor we should consider in this kind of climate emergency. So I would summarize these as the main factors, and lots of work is being put now into these to really try to understand how we can also advise and give recommendation to our patient with epilepsy in the context of climate change.
Yeah, very important information. I think a lot of that actually applies to everybody of us, not only for the patients, but also for all of us to keep cool in every sense and to drink enough if it's really getting warm and also to take care that the medication doesn't get too hot. I think that's another topic, that some medications are probably not so prone to be ruined by heat, but others might suffer from too high temperatures when taking with you. So be aware that medication is kind of room temperature on a climate air-conditioned room.
And the other aspect, sorry, I forgot, is sleep. We also know there is good evidence that climate changes and especially high temperature may affect sleep. And then that becomes a vicious circle, because we know how sleep is essential in people with epilepsy. So, of course, we should recommend to try to keep the sleep condition as comfortable as possible.
As again, which is also true for all of us. Marianne?
That's an important point, Simona, because it's not only the climate, the local climate, but also jet lag that may play a role. So if there are differences in time zones, this is also another factor that may be important for people in epilepsy, particularly in those who have genetic syndromes, who may be very prone to having seizures after sleep deprivation. So in these cases, where we expect there may be some jet lag or a time zone difference, there may be necessary to recommend some prophylactic treatment. For example, we use clobazam for a couple of days in our patients. They may start this even slightly before their flight, like or on the day of flying, and then continue this for a couple of days after they land at their destination. So this will give them some additional protection. But what I found interesting is that there was a recent study in brain that showed that it's not only sleep deprivation, but really changes in the wake and sleep cycle. So any change in time zone may actually provoke seizures, even if people sleep enough. So even if they manage, for example, to sleep on their planes. And this can be also seen in the Arctic. So there is some very interesting research done in the Arctic. So they have these huge fluctuations in day and night. And during the times when the days get massively longer, so that's usually during April, May, June, people are much more prone to having seizures or status epilepticus. And that just shows us how big of an impact sleep and sleep deprivation and the wake and sleep cycles may have in some people with epilepsy.
Very interesting point. Thank you, Marian, for that. So there can something happen, of course, on traveling? Should people with epilepsy apply for special health care cover for their traveling abroad, or do they need special travel insurance? Do you think so?
Yes, so this is something we always discuss with our patients who wish to travel. I always advise to check with the embassy of the patient where they are going to see what their requirements are. Usually, for example, if they travel in Europe, they have access to emergency services. They have free access. But of course, they may also want to have a travel insurance because that ensure more coverage, especially when, again, we are facing people with more severe condition and with comorbidities. Then I think it's always important to have a travel insurance which they may cover them in case of any sort of complication.
Very good. So what are the risks in case of gastrointestinal or other infections when traveling abroad? There is, I suppose, an increased risk in some countries. So do have epilepsy patients have to take special care of that?
Yes. So people with epilepsy should not expose themselves to unwashed foods or to tap water that may be contaminated in some countries. And if they cannot ingest the tablets reliably, that may cause problems and seizures. So in these cases, in the worst case, they may need IV medication if they cannot ingest the tablets. And I usually also recommend as a rule of thumb, if a person with epilepsy takes a tablet, but if vomiting occurs within around 30 minutes of the intake of the medication, it's usually recommended for them to take the medication again because probably it wasn't sufficiently taken up by the body.
Very helpful advice. And another health care problem sometimes is that traveling to certain countries requires specific vaccinations or even malaria prophylaxis. And that can be even troublesome for people without epilepsy. Now, are there also special requirements for people with epilepsy? What is safe for them?
Yes, so that's a very important point as well. So travel vaccination can protect against infectious disease when visiting some countries. And I can say generally that most vaccine will not affect seizures or interact with the seizure medication. But I think that again, this need to be really weighted in against the individual profile. So I think it's always important to have a specific discussion. For example, some anti-malarial medication can trigger seizure and are not suitable for people with epilepsy. And again, there are some type of epilepsy that are more predisposed, let's say, to have seizure in the context of fever. So in those people, definitely vaccination are more important, but equally the reaction to vaccination may trigger a seizure. So I always have a discussion with the patient and sometimes also with the GP to discuss which vaccine are definitely essential in that specific patient. And also we always discuss anti-malaria prophylaxis as needed because, as I said, not all medication are suitable in people with epilepsy.
So it should always be discussed with the epileptologist before getting vaccination and taking malaria prophylaxis, which is suitable.
Yeah, I think it's important. And of course, as for any person traveling, they should check what vaccination. There are some vaccination, of course, that are mandatory anyway.
Yeah. Then you have to take the risk anyhow. Now, coming as last point, maybe to one of my favorite points, always trying to do as much sport as possible. So are there any specific activities or sports people with epilepsy should avoid while traveling? Are there any special risks?
Most people with epilepsy can participate in many, many sports activities. But I'm particularly careful with swimming. And this is something I tell every epilepsy patient, because swimming is the number one cause of severe epilepsy-related injuries and even death. So I do not recommend to swim to people who have uncontrolled epilepsy or frequent seizures. In those who have well-controlled seizures, swimming may be permissible, but this is only reasonable, I think, if they are accompanied by somebody when they're venturing into deep water. And this is obviously a risk that they need to carry themselves. So nothing in life is without risk. And in people with epilepsy, I guess swimming carries one of the highest risks for injuries or even death. On the other hand, I like to tell them stories of famous athletes with epilepsy. And one of them is Imogen Clarke. I think she was a British swimmer, and she was even very good. She placed fourth at world championships, and she had epilepsy, and she even had seizures at the poolside. And her parents were told that she has to stop swimming because this was very dangerous. But fortunately, her seizures were then well controlled, and it was okay for her to swim every day. So even people with epilepsy, in certain cases, when they're supervised, can get into the pool, but it very much depends on the individual situation. And another issue that's a bit tricky is scuba diving. This is a popular activity in many countries, and that's usually also not recommended in people with epilepsy, particularly those of uncontrolled seizures. And the regulations are very, very strict with scuba diving, so most of the diving authorities will not allow for a person with epilepsy to dive. And there is a small minority of these diving authorities that may allow people with epilepsy to dive, but only after long seizure-free intervals. So some say at least 3 years seizure freedom without medication. Others say even more than that, even 5 years seizure freedom without medication. So regulations are very, very strict.
Yeah, thank you. I think we definitely need a special episode about sports and epilepsy, which will be coming soon, sometime later in the year or beginning of next year. Well, that will be fun too. So it was very interesting to talk to you today. I got a lot of inputs for recommendations for people with epilepsy. I thank you very much for taking your time today, and have a nice rest of the day. Thank you. Bye-bye, Simona and Marian.
Thank you. Thank you, Barbara.
Have a good rest.
Thank you, Mariam.
This has been EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. EAN Cast Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.